You're listening to a download from theoutdoorstation.co.uk. Number 457.
Hello and welcome back to The Outdoor Station, and this the first podcast of a two-part interview with the well-known author Keith Foskett, or Fozzie, as he's probably better known to his hiking buddies. The release of this interview on Friday the 16th of March 2018 has been timed to coincide with the online launch of his latest book, High and Low. As outdoor books go, it is slightly unusual in flavour, as it mixes not only Keith's natural storytelling ability with a good dose of humour, but also some excellent descriptions of several of the best UK trails, along with a subject rarely found in the outdoor library, and that is depression. It's all handled in Keith's unique style. And if you want to know more, pop along to theoutdoorstation.co.uk or keithfoskett.com and you'll find all the photographs, information and links there. Enjoy!
Okay, High and Low is the memoir of a hike I did across Scotland in 2016, starting on the Cape Wrath Trail, going on to the West Highland Way, and then hiking over to the east side, to the English border at Kirkyetholm. It was about 600 miles. So it's a memoir about that trip, what happened. There's elements of humour, as usual with my writing. And there's also a serious side to the book as well, in that it was the whole trip was a realization that I was suffering from depression. So there's kind of two aspects to the book, really.
The start of it grips you straight away, certainly. And I was with you, as it were, as you were explaining what happened, which was basically you were on the CDT. This was the result of a 3-year preparation and plan to take that big walk, which in itself must have been exciting. But the symptoms you suddenly came down with on that morning were, certainly as it reads and as I'm sure you felt at the time, the symptoms of a heart attack. And there you were in the middle of nowhere, literally on your own. So lead us through that particular part of the book.
I woke up, I don't know, normally sort of 7 o'clock in the morning, had something to eat. I'd camped in a forest at the time and I had a bit of a climb, nothing major. And I guess I left camp about 8 o'clock, and over the course of about two and a half hours, I just had sort of a slight chest pain where my heart was, which was slightly worrying, obviously. But what was also concerning was my breathing was becoming a lot more shallower. So instead of like taking a big lung full of air and then a big exhalation, it was only kind of, I could only draw in half the capacity. So obviously then I was starting to get a little bit stressed, wondering why, what was going on. That just made the situation worse. I thought it was, I just thought I was having a bad day, so I carried on walking. And then eventually I got to the point where I thought, no, something's not right. And I sat down. And at that point, the chest pain was quite severe and my breathing was really very shallow, almost to the point where I was sort of gasping for air. And at that precise moment, a guy that I'd been hiking with called Charlie, he, by some minor miracle, come up behind me. Now, he's a paramedic with the ski service. So in terms of the ideal person you want to turn up, it was him. And he just did a few checks. He sort of regularly took my pulse and asked me a few questions. And we decided that, or he decided that chest pain wasn't something you muck around with. Amazingly, we had a tiny cellular signal right out in the middle of the New Mexican mountains. And we called the emergency services, and about 50 minutes later, a chopper came over the horizon, took me back to Albuquerque Hospital, they initially diagnosed her bronchitis, gave me a load of antibiotics, and basically said, don't do anything strenuous for 4 weeks, which at that point would have put me so far behind target, both sort of financially and in terms of mileage. I decided to make the decision and came home. And at that point, it unfortunately didn't clear up. I had to see the doctors over here, and they diagnosed pneumonia. Gave me some more antibiotics with different antibiotics, and it did eventually clear up a couple of weeks after that. And I guess about 4 weeks after that, I flew up, went up to Scotland to start the Scottish Hike, which is the book about. So that's how it kind of eventually, or how it originally came about.
The highs, lows of just that part of the story itself, for me, must have been incredible, in the sense that this was a 3-year preparation that you had put into practice, and you've obviously been looking forward to it, not only financially but also emotionally, and putting your world in order so you could go and do this trip. So mentally, that must have been an almighty kick in the pants, not to mention financially, getting a ticket to come back.
Do you know, strangely enough, it was actually a relief, which when I tell most people that, they're kind of surprised, obviously, but I remember waking up in the motel room the day after I'd been to hospital, and it kind of dawned on me that my CDT hike was over. And I remember lying there in the bed wondering what to do. And I remember thinking, why aren't you disappointed? Why are you almost relieved? And I was relieved. And I kind of, to a certain extent, I was trying to fight it, thinking, no, you shouldn't be relieved. You should be upset. So I'm almost trying to change my opinion on it. But there was no escaping. For some strange reason, I was relieved that it was over. And I think, sort of looking back afterwards, those 500 miles on the CDT were, I wasn't happy for most of it, and I couldn't put my finger on it. I don't know what it was, but I wasn't enjoying the hiking particularly. Physically, I didn't feel great, which, you know, obviously sort of came to that outcome. But I just mentally or psychologically, I wasn't there. I don't know why I wasn't enjoying it as much as I normally would do. And I just wasn't excited about the next 4 months of getting up to Canada. And I think it wasn't until I came back that I realized that, at the time, that was not the start of the depression thing, because I think I had it for 2 or 3 years before that, but it was the depression just sort of manifesting itself. That's one of the symptoms, almost, that it doesn't matter what you're doing, even the things you really enjoy in life and the stuff you really love, sometimes you just feel so down. And I think it was not immediately after I came back, but during the course of the Scottish hike and the months afterwards, I finally figured out what was happening, that it was the depression.
I thought the comment you make in the book, that your mother was fairly perceptive, and then she said that, you know, you just didn't seem right when you left for America.
Yes. That's one of her favourite sayings. Bless her. She's, I guess your parents know you better than anybody. But, and I'm not, the most forthcoming person with coming out with my feelings. If people ask me sort of how I am, even if I'm, if I've got a lot of problems, I'll just say I'm fine. A lot of people sort of, I'm fine, and you sort of leave it. But yeah, she was quite perceptive, and. You don't seem right was a saying she sort of would come out with. She knew when something was wrong, and she picked up on it fairly easily. So
the previous podcast to this particular one will be the recordings from my 2008 trip to Cape Wrath, heading north. And hopefully people will have listened to that before we start talking about Cape Wrath now, to get a similar or an interesting, different viewpoint on the actual area and the walk itself. You did 3 years to prepare for the CDT, and then, as you say, within a few weeks of coming back and sort of recouping, you headed off north to Cape Wrath. That's a bit of a difference in preparation and planning, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, when you say, you know, when sort of people hear 3 years preparation for the CDT, I mean, it's not as if, you know, my everyday training and, you know, going up the gym and everything. It's, I mean, the preparation is a lot lesser now. I guess the idea, or 3 years, was the idea behind the CDT. It was 3 years of ideas that sort of came together. But Scotland was very sort of random. I guess I was kind of disappointed with coming back from the CDT and then trying to figure out what was going on. And normally if things aren't going well in my life, then the first thing I do is I'll go for a hike. I'll escape to the outdoors where I can think. And I was just looking around for ideas, and I was speaking to Alex Roddy, a friend of mine, who edits my books amongst other things and does some stuff for TGO.
Yeah, yeah. We know Alex, friend of the station.
Yes, I'm sure he is. And he was doing or just finished the Cape Wrath Trail. And we were just chatting. And I mentioned, you know, I had sort of four weeks or so to go and do a hike. I was struggling to figure out what to do. And he just sort of casually mentioned he finished the Cape Wrath Trail. So we got talking, and literally 2 days later, I got off the coach at Durness and started the following day. So in terms of planning on the Scottish walk, it was literally, you know, it was just sort of 3 days. I had all my stuff was ready still from the CDT, so I just needed the idea. And the ambition or one on the bucket list was always to walk across Scotland. It had been there for years, and I thought it'd be a case of waiting for the sort of right time, but as it turned out, it just sort of cropped up.
It presented itself to you.
Yeah, completely innocently at the right time.
So what did you make of Durness then? I definitely felt it was like a frontier town, you know, last stop before infinity.
I kind of liked Durness, actually. It was very quiet, a little bit sleepy, everything there you need, really. You can get a bed for the night, or you're somewhere to pitch your tent, you can get something to eat, you can grab a couple of beers. It was a nice little place, but I know what you mean. It is, you know, there's nothing north until you hit Antarctica, I suppose. So it is kind of the end of the road. You can't go any further. So either the end of the road or, you know, you turn around and face south and it's the start. So
yeah.
I liked the place.
But I see that you had the what I'd class as the soft approach. You crossed the estuary there, and there was a minibus to take you to the lighthouse. I had to walk that 10 miles. It was a blooming pain.
I didn't even know the minibus was there, actually. I remember doing a little bit of research, and all I remember was seeing was Durness was kind of like last stop on the line, and you have to sort of make your way from there. And I think it was Alex that mentioned the minibus. I felt kind of sorry for it, because it's kind of, as I said in the book, it's kind of like imprisoned on that lonely stretch of road forever, because it can't get off the ferry, or the ferry doesn't take vehicles, so it's stuck on this few miles of rough track up to the lighthouse and back to the little Kyle of Durness. And it's never going to escape. It makes you feel kind of sorry for it.
Yeah, you can just imagine it in years and years to come. It's just running on its wheel rims and the rubbers.
Yeah, it will still be there, chugging up and down that track.
Yeah. Somebody will use it for target practice. First of all, I think first we need to say to people, if they haven't listened to the previous podcast and they're not aware of the Cape Wrath Trail, that actually it is a military area, and it actually has live firing, which is where they bomb and send off their missiles from the various boats and use it for target practice. So from a safety point of view, people who, if they're ever considering the Cape Wrath Trail, just need to do a little bit of research, and there are the appropriate telephone numbers and websites to contact to see when that live firing is. But is it something that you checked before you started?
I had a phone number which you call, which basically gives you an update on what's going on. Sometimes it might be something like, you know, the firing range is in operation for 3 days. Check back after that, and certainly don't go hiking or walking or anything. What I found was a bit strange was when I rung it, there was an answer phone on. And I thought, you know, I'm just about to sort of start on the Cape Wrath Trail and walk through a pretty heavily bombarded area where the military are taking pot shots. You could have at least had someone to answer the phone call.
Do you know, when I read that bit in your book, I couldn't help but think of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where they say that the automatic machine, well, the nuclear weapons that are heading your way are merely an introduction to our welcome that we have on this planet. Thanks for calling the Cape Wrath Trail. The bombs that are heading your way will actually be falling somewhere between your lunch and breakfast. We hope you enjoy your trip.
Yeah, exactly. I think I was quite lucky because I think I got up there on a Thursday or something, and the latest news I had, unfortunately, on the way up was that they were doing some sort of exercise right up until the Sunday. But when I rung on the Thursday, they did ring me back about an hour later and said, you're in luck. It's all been sort of cooled off, so you can start your hike. So it didn't really interrupt things at all. But, yeah, certainly if you're going or if you're starting the Cape Wrath Trail for the northern end or coming into it from the southern end, you certainly need to make sure that it's not in use.
Definitely. Okay, so just to give some people some perspective then, when was this and what time of year were we talking about?
It was 2016, and from the top of my head, I started the middle of July, so it was pretty much the height of summer.
So the weather should have been good then?
I had a sudden urge to swear. The weather was diabolical, absolutely diabolical. I had, I think, two or three days of really nice weather on the West Highland Way, but I remember totting up. Not that I kept a record, but obviously I knew the days when it did sort of rain and kept a note in my diary. But at the end of it, I think the whole hike took 31 days, and I think it rained for something like 28 of them at some point during the day. So, yeah, it was the conditions were pretty dire, to say the least.
And so did you, like us, find that Cape Wrath section is, even on a good day, pretty boggy going?
Yeah, I think even when the sun was shining, I'd say the Cape Wrath Trail is probably well. The strange thing is they call it a trail, and it's when you actually do sort of hit some sort of firm footing or track or something like that is actually quite rare. I mean, I don't know what the statistics would be, but at a rough guess, I would say probably 70 to 80% of the time there's no trail at all when you're going over. You know, just sort of moorland and boggy, muddy ground. And sometimes you kind of like look down a valley and you can pick out little bits of track, you know, lighter sections of dirt or rock. But it's definitely a tough one. I remember leaving the walking south from the lighthouse at Cape Wrath, and I think after about a mile, according to my map, the track sort of went off right and southwards off this this road, and I reached there and I was checking the GPS and everything, so I knew exactly where I was, and my location was right bang on the start of this track, and I just looked down, there was nothing there, and I thought, well, this must be wrong. I've probably been mollycoddled a bit or walking the trails in the States where there's always a trail there, so I guess my head was saying there's no trail, it must be wrong, but it was in fact right. And that was pretty much, after a mile on the road, that was my wake-up call to the Cape Wrath Trail. I walked off the road, followed my bearing, the GPS coordinates, and pretty much at the bottom I just hit sort of bog and both feet went under, and I don't think I had dry feet for certainly the whole duration of the Cape Wrath Trail, but it was a pretty rude awakening, yeah.
Well, as you say, it's a pretty remote trail. It's probably the most remote trail in the UK that's left, I would think. And I think a lot of people don't realise it is quite a challenge to do it. I mean, certainly we did it heading north. Coming south, we met a few people, I seem to recall, and they were heavily laden and obviously pretty despondent because, yeah, we're dry or wet, the conditions are pretty tough going anyway. But when you get down to sort of get past the toughest part, which is from there to Sandwood Bay, how did you feel about Sandwood Bay when you found it? I thought it was a glorious location.
Yeah, Sandwood Bay's, I think that's partially the reason for doing that trail as well, because Sandwood Bay was another thing on the bucket list. You see the photos of it, and I think it's two reasons for me. Is A, that it's, I wouldn't say necessarily remote, because you can sort of walk in from a road in about an hour, I believe, but you know, it's generally sort of not the sort of place where you'll get thousands of families having a sort of beach holiday. So there's the remoteness of it, and secondly, just the beauty of it. It's just such a long stretch of sand. When I got there, there was no footprints at all on it. I think I was the first, must have been the first person to walk on it that day. And then there's the mysteries that surround it as well. You know, the tales of... there's a few ghost stories floating around. There's the whole Viking thing. Apparently the Vikings used to pull their boats in and pull them into the loch, I presume, to shelter from bad weather, that sort of thing. So it's a fascinating place, and it did live up to expectations. It's such a wonderful thing to look at more than anything.
The Outdoor Station is your one-stop shop for audio and video entertainment for the self-powered traveller. You can find us online, on internet radio, on smartphones, on smart TVs, on YouTube, on Apple TV, on Now TV, and on Facebook. You can also stream us live via the iTunes app or TuneIn radio app. The list is continually expanding, and for full details of how to subscribe, download or stream and enjoy our massive free library, please visit theoutdoorstation.co.uk. So let's sort of continue our journey then. You've got past that part, and then you sort of start to get to the midsection, I guess, of the Cape Wrath Trail, and things settle down a bit. As you say, you didn't have the best luck with regards to the weather and the midges, I presume, as well. One thing I do want to just flag up with you is that in reading the book, now you'll forgive me because obviously I'm a bit of a purist. I was astounded that you did absolutely everything based on the phone and the GPS system and the mapping system on the phone. You didn't actually have a full-size map anywhere.
I didn't, no. I think that's probably just something that's stayed with me from the trails in the US, although when I did the PCT in 2010, we did have maps at that point. But the Appalachian Trail in 2012, I did just using my phone. I know the purists will probably cast scorn over me, but to be honest, Bob, I just prefer it. It's easy. I can use a map and compass. I go out and sort of practice my map reading, fairly limited skills, I suppose. But it was the ease of use. My phone was sort of kept in a little pocket on my sternum strap, so I could just pull it out sort of fairly easily and look at it. There was a weather element as well, not only the rain but the wind, which, as you probably know, is never conducive to good map reading. I think it was just ease of use. People do frown on it. I think a lot of people use it. There is the element of risk in that, yes, you could sort of drop your phone in a puddle, your battery could go flat, but... I try to sort of have things in backup. I have my battery pack, I think, is capable of charging the phone a good 8 times, which is certainly a week's worth of use. And I also carry a spare phone in the pack as well. I don't know. It's a strange one. Some people like it. Some people don't. I think it's just technology. It's progress. And to me, that's just the way I prefer doing it.
Oh, there's certainly arguments either way. I was just saying it just came as a bit of a shock that you were relying primarily on a smartphone. However, having said that, if you're doing 600 or so miles, that's a hell of a lot of maps you'd have to be storing and posting ahead and all the rest of it. So, you know, there is argument that if you're keeping generally to established trails, which you sort of were apart from Cape Wrath, which is, as you say, a bit iffy, you know, you could argue that you don't really need them. So, you know, I was just interested in hearing your comments, really.
Just purely personal preference, that's all. It's just the ease of use. I think the other thing that appeals about the smartphone apps is that you do get a precise bearing as well. And believe me, there was a few occasions on on the Cape Breath Trail when I was halfway up a steep-sided valley and the rain was coming at me like you wouldn't believe. And it's not the sort of place where, you know, you'd want to be pulling a map out and trying to triangulate your position. To have that technology on my phone where I could literally just sort of pull a rain jacket or pull it under my rain jacket and then look at it, and I knew that's exactly where I was and what I needed to do, where I needed to go to get away from it, was, you know, that for me was more than worth its weight in gold.
Something that I think most walkers listening to this will agree with and understand is that when you actually get out on the trail and start doing your hike, whatever country you're in, you sort of mentally get into a groove about the way that you move, or your thoughts on where you are, or the trail you're trying to follow, or trying to find and pick up and navigate and so on. And I loved your description of the paths of limitless Guinness and paths of dystopia.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, yeah, I've been there. Oh, yeah, I've heard that. Did you explain that to people?
This was, I guess, again, this was mainly connected to the Cape Breath Trail, because the paths improved drastically once you gone on the West Highland Way. But as we said, the Cape Breath Trail is most of the time there isn't even a trail there. So I kind of spent most of my days trudging through, you know, uneven ground with soaked feet, cursing the trail for the first few days. And I referred to those sections of trail as dystopia, because they were pretty much the, you know, the lowest you could get. And when I hit solid trail, whether it was, you know, a dirt trail or a, you know, a nice section of rock for half a mile or a mile or maybe 3 miles, I guess it was the utopia was the first word that sprung into my mind. But I thought, well, how do you feel when you're in utopia? And I just thought, well, sitting in a bar drinking a pint of Guinness. So that's what the good sections ended up being called, which was a path of limitless Guinness.
Yeah, I think it was an excellent description. And certainly if you've been through the wilds in those sort of conditions, it lives up to expectations. It's perfect. Limitless Guinness. And I know a few people that would really enjoy that too. Your description of wet feet and footwear and that sort of stuff, but you never quite clarify whether you're wearing boots or your trail shoes or you've got any particular flavours each way. And there's obviously a lot of arguments for and against. I'm more of a trail shoe person. Some people are more boots orientated. But what are your thoughts on footwear, especially with the number of miles you've got under your belt?
I'm very much, it depends on the sort of the climate, B, it depends on the trail, and obviously there's a whole other host of factors, but generally, once I hit sort of summer, at least in the UK, so, you know, sort of April through to sort of September, October, I would generally wear trail shoes, non-Gore-Tex, and in the winter when it's, the conditions deteriorate, you know, the rain starts coming in and the snow, I'll usually switch to ankle-length Gore-Tex boots. On the Cape Breath Trail, it was a bit of a quandary because it was the middle of the summer, which dictated I should be wearing trail shoes, non-Gore-Tex. But obviously I knew, A, it was Scotland, and B, that the trail was seriously boggy in sections. And in my limited experience of wearing Gore-Tex boots in the summer, in those sort of conditions, I know they usually create more problems than they solve, especially on the Cape Breath Trail, because sometimes the water was, when you do put your foot down and the ground sort of swallows it up in this sponge abyss, it inevitably goes over the top of your boots and inside. And once that happens, it's Gore-Tex boots just seem to take ages to dry out. So I kind of figured from the start that I was going to have wet feet for the whole of the Cape Breath Trail, and I decided I'd just rather have footwear that at least dried out to a certain extent overnight. So I went with, I think I ended up wearing Brooks Cascadias, which is my normal choice of footwear, and they did very well, but Yeah, it's. I'm glad I didn't wear Gore-Tex, put it that way. I think that they all have their place, but Gore-Tex boots on the Cape Wrath trail, I wouldn't recommend, because they'll get wet at some point. It'll just take ages to dry out.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. It's like wearing two buckets. Once they're wet, they're full. Two buckets on your feet, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great at keeping water out, but conversely, keeping water out, but once it's in, it can't get out as well.
And the other thing that, again, you refer to as your bat cave, which I thought was quite an interesting combination of stuff. And I've not really met anybody who uses a poncho in those sort of conditions, because I tend to find that they've got a life of their own and the wind gets them and it's like wearing a body bag, you know, they're all over the place. But obviously you've had great success with that sort of system.
Again, it does depend on where you are and what sort of trail, but... I think the thing with a poncho for me initially was the amount of weight it saved, because I think the poncho I've got is ridiculously light. I can't remember what it weighs, but it's probably a couple of hundred grams. That's about it. Now, if you take into account, say a Gore-Tex waterproof jacket, waterproof trousers, and pack cover, in some respects, you've got about a kilo's worth of gear. So... primarily for me, it was a weight saving thing. I certainly wouldn't use it in the winter. There's just too much chance of getting into dangerous situations with hypothermia, that sort of thing. But in the summer, it's great. It's super quick. As soon as it starts sort of raining, I kept it in a side pocket on my pack. So I literally reached around with my hand. Unwrapped it, sort of put it over my head. It covered all my pack as well, so I don't have to worry about a pack cover or my contents of my pack getting wet. And it stopped sort of just above my knees, so I always got wet below my knees and my shoes, but in the middle of the summer, it doesn't really matter anyway. And I don't know, I just like the ease of it. The weight's fantastic. It doesn't weigh anything. It's incredibly effective. Had a small sort of hood as well, but the upper half of my body and my shorts always, even in the most heaviest of downpours, were always dry. And more importantly, it kept my pack and everything in my pack dry as well. But like I say, it's only for certain sort of situations. I certainly wouldn't go winter mountaineering in a poncho. I recommend anybody does either.
So was it Cuban fibre then, or siliconised nylon? And what about your arms? Is it sort of two holes and your arms are out, or are they tucked in?
Yeah, it's kind of, if you can imagine, sort of a T-shirt, so your arms are exposed as well. And yes, it was, or is rather, because I still have it, made of Cuban fibre. I don't know how much a nylon or a sil nylon version would weigh. I would imagine... 300 grams, I suppose, something like that. It's not a huge weight difference, but...
Yeah, interesting. No, just again, it's just, you know, you get into the groove of reading something and you understand where somebody is, and then it's sort of little things like this come out and you go, oh, that's an interesting approach. I've never considered that before. As I say, my experience in ponchos is they tend to sort of take off and me with them, unfortunately.
I think it's because it's a relatively tight fit. Once your pack is underneath it, it's kind of... the circumference of the poncho is kind of quite sort of taut and tight. So it's not one of these. I mean, I did have an old sil nylon poncho, which was just, it was just so big. I think I had tents that use less material than that that poncho. And yeah, I remember actually wearing it. First time I wore it, I was to the top of Penny Gant, and I remember hitting the summit, and this gust of wind just flew over the summit, lifted the top off and blew it straight over my head, and I couldn't get out of the thing. So I was, you know, top of the mountain in a howling gale, and I just couldn't find a way out of this poncho. And I think I got home and promptly gave it away. But the Cuban fibre ones, it's a far better design. It's more of a snug fit.
The other thing I was thinking was unusual for this country, certainly I've seen it happen, certainly in Europe and definitely the States, is your use of an umbrella.
Yes. I think that sort of stems from the whole lightweight approach, the ultralight or or hyperlight, whichever bracket you want to put it in. And there are sort of restrictions. A lot of people sort of look at a poncho and an umbrella and think, no, if you're going up to Scotland, you need full Gore-Tex jacket, trousers and boots and all this sort of thing. And on occasions you do, but the umbrella, strangely enough, came about not because of rain, but because of sun. I only started using one in 2010 on the Pacific Crest Trail, and the first 700 miles a desert terrain until you hit the Sierra Nevadas. And most people, I mean, the chances of rain is extremely, extremely unlikely, but everybody or a lot of people are taking umbrellas. And after a couple of days, I figured out why, just because of the heat and the sunlight. The last thing you want to do is wearing sort of long trousers and long sleeve shirts and hats, because you just get too hot. So we just had shorts, t-shirts, and we just put the umbrella up, and it was fantastic, especially at break times, because often there's just no trees about. So you were sitting down in full sun, which was just so uncomfortable. We just used to pop our umbrellas up and get a little bit of shade. And it's just sort of stayed with us. If I go out, even on a day hike now, I always take the umbrella. Just saves, you know, stopping, taking your boots off, putting your trousers on, putting your jacket on, putting your pack cover on, at which point 90% of the time it stopped raining when you've done all of that.
Yeah, sure.
It's just ease, I suppose. But yeah, some people like them, some people don't.
Well, I mean, what make is it? Is it a specific hiking umbrella, or is it just a general cheapy umbrella?
I originally used what's called a Go-Lite chrome dome. As you're probably aware, Go-Lite, I believe Go-Lite have gone out of business now last year. I'm not sure, but I think they have. Mm. And that particular design, again, was primarily for sun protection. It was the outer surface was silver, so it reflected the heat and the light back. It was also incredibly light. I think it was something like a couple of hundred grams. When Go-Lite went bust, I was frantically trying to search around for a replacement, but obviously people had sort of grabbed them, and I came across a company in Germany called Euroscherm, who made an exact model, and having spoken to them a few times with a few emails, it actually transpired that they actually made the chrome dome for Go-Lite. So it's exactly the same umbrella. And it's great. I love it. It's just, I think, primarily, again, because it was light, and just it's the umbrella I became used to using in the States, and, you know, it works, so I had no reason to change it. I still have one now.
Well, that brings us to the end of part one, and if you want to hear more about Keith, his hiking style, and, of course, his journey in the book High and Low, then tune in same time next week. Now, I enjoyed the book and could empathise with many of the situations and emotions that Keith touched on within. But don't take my word for it. Visit theoutdoorstation.co.uk or keithfoskett.com, where you will find out more, see photographs, links, etc., and of course nab a copy for yourself should you so wish. My thanks to Keith for sharing his thoughts, and to you for listening. Now, I'd really appreciate it if you could take a few moments to add comments to any of the social media we have dotted around the place and share it to your circle of friends. It all helps to keep our profile high these days, and social media and algorithms are everything. Finally, let's finish off by using Keith's strapline from his page. When dealing with emotional baggage, it's best to pack light. Until next time, folks, bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorsstation.co.uk.